Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980. Today we're listening to Captain L.M. Hinchcliffe, DSC, RAN. This talk's entitled Navy Odds and Ends, and gives an account of his experiences in World War II, from the moment of receiving a signal announcing war with Germany until a Japanese surrender. It was recorded on the 2nd of May, 1980, and duration is 1 hour and 20 minutes.
When I finished my last talk, I think I concluded with bumping my head against the leading signalman's head, as we both roared for the voice pipe at about 9 o'clock, expecting the signal total Germany, and we got it. Well, we were off Sydney on patrol. We were the only ship out that night, a pretty wild night, and one of the things that, of course, immediately came into being was the recognition signals. And for those of you who remember, in those days, they not only consisted of a signal letter or letters, but we also had the red, green, and white lights strung up the mast and so on. And I must admit that not one of us thought that we'd be given the challenge by the flagship coming out through the heads, but we were. And I've forgotten why, at a particular time, we weren't really alert enough to push our button, but we didn't. And we started the war off then with a frightful bottle in this vendetta. However, we were eventually sent off to our war station, and that was some miles out to the east of Newcastle. And again, you may remember, I mentioned that a week before the war, there had been a German merchant ship called the Lahn, which sneaked out of harbour on the Friday night, in the middle of the night, and the warpies reported that they had seen down below some 6-inch gun barrels. And of course, everybody thought, well, when they've seen it, they know what they're talking about. And we were raced off to have a look for them. We never did catch them up. But on our way to our war station, a vessel very much like the silhouette of the Lahn turned up. And we snuck up behind him, and this is our first real worry of the war. And it turned out to be a bank liner, and he went to panic stations completely. So we weren't far short of it, I suppose, but there it was. After that little episode, for a couple of days on, I think it was 2 days on patrol, for everybody, we were sent into the nearest ports to show the flag and let everybody see that the RAM was at sea and it had all its guns on board and ammunition. In our case, of course, the bullets were kept in the guardrails, which these days, of course, is anathema to people, but that's where they were. So they could visibly see the fact that we were with ammunition, I'd say. Newcastle turned up one particular point, which no one ever bothered to tell us, and that is that the BHP place there had installed an 8-inch projectile manufacturing plant. And they showed it to us, and they reckoned that in about 3 or 4 hours operation, they could do all our practice ammunition shoots for the 2 8-inch cruisers, they could renew them in that small time. Well, this seemed to us to be a pretty good thing. It should have been spread around a bit. From Newcastle, we returned to Sydney and went off later on to help Adelaide, that mighty battleship that everyone seemed to think that it could do a good job. I suppose she did in the end, but one of the things that caught up with us there was, as we went round into Bass Straits, we were on our way to Melbourne, we decided we'd have to show everybody, including ourselves, how the high-speed destroyer sweep, it was a mine sweep, which most destroyers were fitted with at one time, either the high-speed one or the two-speed one. Well, the old V's and W's had the high-speed, and it hadn't been run in my time in the ship, so we had to do it. Everybody was mustered aft at 1:15, and I happened to be down aft, and the captain was holding the bridge, and looked forward, and there was a black line right across the horizon, typical Bass Strait. Before we could even get the sweep in, we were digging our nose right under. And that night, Adelaide decided he wanted to crack on. We were darkened, and as we passed the prom, a very dim light came out, what ship? We just sent back British warship and left it at that. When we got into Williamstown to fuel, there was a message from the lighthouse keeper. He was terribly sorry to have made us disclose our position, but he could see the sheet of spray going by and wonder what the hell was making it. Well, the result of that sheet of spray was 52 rivets popped in our forward tanks, and that occasioned another rather oddity. The captain decided to give me the handle from Williamstown across to Port Melbourne, and I did all the usual things, and nothing happened. Half astern together, nothing happened. And finally, the captain got over the back of the bridge and bellowed down aft in the usual style and the destroyer, "What the bloody hell's wrong with the engine, Mr. Cook?" And up came Mr. Cook with his head up the thing there, "Bloody oil in the bloody fuel, sir." I think it was the Anchises or something, one of the blue funnel liners alongside watching all this caper, and they were roaring their heads off. But we did manage to get one heaving line ashore and saved ourselves. After that, we completed, and all destroyers were then sent up to Singapore to, all the V's and W's were sent up to Singapore to, for AS exercises. We hadn't got a submarine down in Australia and hadn't had one for some time. They brought up one in 38, I think. And we were going up there for 6 weeks and to come back to Australia. Well, I was away for 4 years. A lot of other people were somewhat from the same time, but we moved on from Singapore to Colombo, and I had my first job then as an embryo doctor in diagnosing that our own doctor had an appendicitis. I don't think he's here tonight, but I often wonder if he really had one, but anyway, someone extracted something from his guts and we left him behind in Penang. And we're in Colombo, and from Colombo, you might remember that the pocket battleships were spreading themselves around the Atlantic at that time, and one of them was reputed to be coming up the east coast of Africa. Quite why, we didn't really know. Anyway, a couple of them were sent down there, and ourselves and Waterhen were dispatched to go to the men. And the poor old B&W, again, some of you might remember, they had what they called peace tanks. Now, in peacetime, these peace tanks are filled with water, and they are wing tanks under the iron deck. But in wartime, you lost the water and you went to fuel. Well, even with these peace tanks, it became patently obvious about a quarter of the way across that an unexpected set was against us, and things were not going to be so easy. We had started off on one boiler only, with absolutely the minimum of auxiliaries going, and no make-up boiler water, no make-up domestic water at all. And about halfway across, an able seaman who'd cracked his coccyx and had been landed in Colombo for a treatment died. And this had a rather unfortunate repercussion later on. So we had to disclose our position because I, being the intelligence officer, knew that Ramillies was somewhere in the area, and we wanted to have this thing investigated because our own doctor had been gone. We were, of course, in the hands of plenty of other expert, and they reckoned this fellow was all right to travel, and we didn't think he was when he came on board, but you can't go against that. However, nothing happened, and that was my first burial at sea. It was a very solemn process when you first come across it, more especially when you're thinking of the circumstances under... Can you hear me at the back all right?
Yeah.
The circumstances under which it occurred. However, we went on, and we got a quarter of a knot set the other way, and it allowed us to get in with 23 tons, I think it was, of fuel remaining, and Waterhen was our consort. He had something like 10, and we were very, very pleased to get into Aden. I can assure you, with no word of the Graff's Bay and no chance anyway of the whole way over from Colombo to Aden of doing anything about it, even if we had struck it, we'd have been sitting ducks. Well, we happened to be the first into the Med of the Australian fleet. We weren't called a scrap iron flotilla then. I think that we should have been, but not really. In many ways, when we look back on it, we were capable of steaming, we were capable of fighting, and we did have, although a destroyer, we had an anti-submarine set which was normally put in a trawler. Why on earth the government did that, I have no idea. I can't even find it out to this day. But as you know, they did get submarines with it. I don't think it was entirely just, because from memory, Stuart got a couple, and I think Voyager got a couple, didn't he, Bill? At least one, anyway. However, our arrival in Malta is still very vivid in my memory. We went alongside some cruiser, and there was a gaggle of brass on the rail, most of whom had a bit of red between their stripes, and they joined board with us, along with a bloody great tomcat who was after our little girl. And the result of the Board of Inquiry on the subject of the able seaman's untimely death was that the captain got a rap over the knuckles, a pretty solid one, for allowing the French letters and the condoms to get mixed up. As for the able sailor, nothing on that on paper at all. Some of you might appreciate the irony of that one. We did a few convoys from Malta to Marseille, to Haifa, to Alex, Port Said, and nothing happened. They were two-ship, troop ship, or horse ships, and still transporting horses in those days. We did have Christmas in Marseille about 3 days later than it should have been, and it really astonished everybody, I think, just how cold it could be up there. There was ice forming in the harbour, and a couple of years before the war, a poll had been taken in the destroyers that were in commission as to whether the little coal stoves that were fitted in the mess decks and fitted in the captain's cabin in the wardroom should remain or be thrown over the side. And the troops all went on your way, you see. The wardroom didn't, and neither did the captain. We were the only people who were warm. It was terribly cold, it really was, and they were completely stripped, of course. After a couple of months of that, I had been selected to go to England to do a long anti-submarine course. And we were in Alex having 10 days lie-off when the signal came through, and the troop ship came in, and I had to go under that night. Well, being a very young two-striper, I had nothing behind me except what I got every fortnight, and I was broke. Alex was quite expensive if you really want to play the game. And no one in the ship had a bean. And when we got into Malta, it was a Sunday, there was not a soul around the place. The paymaster was holed up somewhere, and I hawked myself around all the destroyers, and I managed to get 10 quid, five of which came from Commander Waller, as he was then, and five from about three other people. And that was all I had to get to England. And when we got to France, to Marseille, we went into a troop train, and by the grace of God, the senior major had a
cabin to himself, and he said, "Well, Hewlett was there, you could do with a bit of help. Come on in with me." So I lived in luxury as far as everybody else was concerned, but they fed the sailors, or the troops. They didn't feed the officers in the British troop trains. So every time the train stopped, you'd see a whole gang of officers hanging out the windows and on the platforms and everything else, and as soon as it stopped, off they went. Well, if you're properly organised, one went for food and the other one went for grog. And this is what happened with my fellow. He said, "I can't run very fast, but you go and get the food and I'll get the grog." So I lived pretty well for about 3 days when it took us across France. But again, some of you will remember how terrible it was to try and extract money from the hierarchy. It was a Saturday when I arrived in London. I was upbraided for dragging out the naval officer, naval liaison officer, from his game of golf on the Saturday afternoon. "And why do all you young bastards arrive broke?" That was the actual greeting as he came through the door. And eventually I put in my claim, which I think amounted to £4.16 or something. I got 2 guineas, and the paymaster of the place I was in said, "This is bloody nonsense, you better complain about this," which I did, so I got 31.6. And that was from Alexandria to London with a night in Southampton in a hotel. I hope it's changed. Well, I went down to Osprey, which was then the home of the Aztec world, and it was situated at Portland, on Portland Bill. And as usual, signals had gone adrift, and I was too late for the course that I was supposed to be in. So I spent a most magnificent month in one of the potentate's yachts. It was a thing called St. Modman. And St. Modman is the patron saint of beer drinkers. And this was owned by the chairman and directors of a man, Crossman Paulin, I think, was the actual firm. And a fantastic time. Beautifully appointed, got everything right into the shut, and we had to chuck off daily and go and do our AS exercises in the training squadron. And that gave me a bit of an insight into what I was going to come up against. Well, whilst I was doing my course, Dunkirk evacuation occurred, and the Admiralty especially sent a signal to say that the long AS course was not to be disturbed. All the other specialist courses were sent off, and we had to carry on because the Atlantic battle then had apparently started to impinge itself on their lordships, that it was going to be crucial. We had a moan and were fallen in, given a dressing down. I remember that with 1, 2.5 go, all the rest of the 2 stripers being upbraided by Captain A.S. But we had to man the bill with a platoon drawn from the sailors who were doing their courses and us who were doing a long course. And this used to start at 6 o'clock in the night and go on all night. Who got any rest? You still had to do your course, whichever way you were going. But the heartening thing then was that the number of boats that came along the coast and came in close and say, "Which way Dunkirk?" And that way. Tremendous number of them. The spirit then was really fantastic. And I don't recall anybody holding up in Portland. We had quite a big harbour there, a base really. And the spirit of these fellows who were coming from all over the place, including Ireland. But on completion of my long course, which I might say was salted by quite a few things. The first of the heavy raids on the harbours took place in Portland, and as I'd had a window seat from the word go, I was the eagle or the cockatoo or something, and I fortunately, as far as I was concerned, fortunately, because I could see what was going on. This merchant ship converted to AA, which was down in the harbour, was actually slaughtered. Well, I saw the whole jolly lot of that. And it was quite a lesson in what one can come up against. But at the same time, we had the magnetic mine menace, and the first of the double L sweepers were down there being tried out. it was fairly flat water, and the bottom was fairly flat as well. This is where they were trying them out, but the thumps all day long as they got these mines is pretty disconcerting. On completion of my long course, I was appointed to what I considered to be a very, very fine appointment, and that was to HMS Western Isles. In fact, HMS Western Isles hadn't arrived at the working up base, which was in Tobermory on the Isle of Mull, Scotland. One of the extraordinary things about Mull is that it's right in the direct line of the tail end of the Gulf Stream. And all sorts of things used to come ashore on the west coast there, including, the, you may remember, the I think it was the Arundora Star, which was sunk with about loss of 400 kids or something on their way to America. Well, a tremendous number of the bodies came ashore on Mull. And it was also famous because the Reddings, the Mitfords, probably is a better name for that, Nancy Mitford and so on. Their seat was there, and but quite a few oddities used to go on around there because the Cloak and Dagger boys were pretty well on the top of it, and I came up against them a couple of times, one because I was an Australian and one because I defended a leading signalman from an obvious fellow who was trying to worm information out of him. I don't know whether you've ever been grilled by intelligence, but when you're put in a dark room and all you can see is a great light shining in on you, it is not funny. Fortunately, my conscience is completely clear, and so are my actions, and I'm just proving it, but it's not nice at all. Anyway, this working up base was to be run, I said to be run, deliberately, by Vice Admiral Gilbert Stevenson. He had made his name in World War I as being the head of the Adriatic Patrol. He had over 1,000 craft under his control, and they're all fairly small, of course, but he did a magnificent job there. And when I first met him, which was during the long course, he had a chest full of ribbons from, he's only a little fella, about that high, from round about there on me up to about just over the back of his shoulder, basically. When he came up in Western Isles, it had been reduced considerably. All the Italian decorations, of course, had to be taken away. But Monkey Face, as he was called, he had great grips here, and very much looked like a monkey, great upper lip and so on, was a colossal character. And he was being employed as a commodore, and he brought this funny old steam of the Western Isles, a coal burner, up into Tobermory. I was living in a pub up till then, and one little story there might interest you. The night I arrived, I was again in an impecunious state. I had fourpence, I think, and at that stage in England, you had to pay your bill in the pub before you were allowed to sleep in the bed. And in somewhat fear and trepidation, I pressed the bell in the little parlour, because the pub was only about from here to the projection room, away from the wharf. And an enormous brute came in, shoulders about that wide and high and so on, and I said, "Are you the publican?" And he said, "Fuck." And I said, "Well, I'd like a drink, and would you care for one too?" He said, "No, I'll bring you one." But he brought me one. And I had that, and I pressed the bell again, and I said, "Would you again care to join in the drink?" "No." So I had that one, and then I pressed the bell again. And I said, "Will you give me a hand up the stairs with my bags?" Well, most of you probably remember the old Gieves tin trunk. I only had one. The rest of mine were wooden. I didn't like Gieves trunks. But there it was. We grabbed hold of this, and I was taken to the back end, so I had to push. And he said, "What's this A between the R and the N?" And I said, "Australia, Royal Australian Navy." "You an Australian?" "Yes." "Well, drop it." "I said, what?" "Drop it." "What? Drop your bag." And there it was on the stairs like that. At 3 o'clock, we passed that, crawling up on either side. He having then said, "Ah, I thought you was a Sassenach." The result of that was I never looked back. I was fed like a fighting cock, no matter what time I came in. And later on, when I had a few days leave and another appointment, they heard I was coming up, and they all were there to meet me on the jetty, and they were terribly disappointed when I said I was staying privately. But that's the way we were thought of up there in Lewisburg, in the Highland Country. But, well, the routine for this working up was quite fantastic. We used to have to be on board the ships at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we'd go out to the grounds where we were. We had our submarine exercise area. This is far too small, but
I've had it in this other thing. But Mull, there you can see Scotland.
Yeah.
Mull's there, and there are two little islands. Islay is one, and Col and Tyree, and they form a triangle, and we were exercising there. Why the Jerrys didn't twig that was going on, well, I don't know, because they could have picked off all the escorts as they were coming up for their working up without any trouble at all, but they didn't. And we only had one visitation. I got there end of June and left the end of November. I think we only had one visitation from an aircraft in all that time, and that had obviously lost its way. It was very, very rugged weather that day, and it didn't do anything to us at all. But we'd go out to this ground, we'd carry on with our anti-submarine exercises for possibly two-thirds of the day, and then we had a tiny little 36-foot private launch to tow a target. We'd pop off with that, get back into harbour, doing discharge reloading drills and gun drills and all sorts of things on the way back. And indeed, the sort of thing that in the end we were doing was presenting them on arrival from their base where they'd either worked up or built, they'd either commissioned or built, and present them with a watch bill. All they do is fill in the names right the way through. We found it was so much simpler, and they also found it so much simpler. And especially when one character said, well, look, sir, what do I do with all these pay envelopes? Well, why? He said, well, that's all I've got. I can't send any correspondence in these. He had 3,000 pay envelopes. And this is the sort of thing that we had to try and iron out. But in the main, they were marvellous. We had from the fishing fleets, the ordinary fishing trawlers, the old ones, the small ones, then the large ones, more particularly, and this is one that I always liked very much indeed, and they were the whalers. These things had very high forecastles. Perhaps you've seen them, photographs of them, but they had very high forecastles, and came away to a deck which had a freeboard roughly of about 2 feet. But they could turn on the sixpence. They really could. They had to, of course, to catch the whales. And as for anti-submarine work, in my book, they were colossal, especially for escort duty, where they could turn around and whack. We had the Admiralty-built trawlers, which were beautiful ships. We had the corvette, which is not the one we had out here. The one we had out here was not a corvette, it was a minesweeper. It was built as a minesweeper, but the corvette over there caught the public imagination. It was brought out here by the good old instrument of the press, and so when they started churning out these AMSs, they were churned out as corvettes. They're quite different to look at. They were also jolly good little ships. They were pretty nasty in some seaways, but they generally were very, very keen, the crews. Their galley was right aft, and one of the things that we insisted upon was that everybody in the ship knew how to set a depth charge.
In other words, set a depth on the depth chart. And one of them, very shortly after it left us, Cookie was hanging out his galley door, which was facing after the depth chart throwers were there and there, the rails were there. He saw a submarine's periscope. So he just walked over, set 50 feet, and pulled the plonker. He got it. Well, I've forgotten which ship that was, but that was a wonderful thing as far as we're concerned. A complete flip for our thoughts and our teaching. Monkey. I'll deal with you later. One of the things which old Monkey Face insisted upon was that people were keen, showed their keenness, and tried to do what was the right thing. And he was completely ruthless as far as anybody who was lax in performing his duty. And I can well recall one morning, I used to work about 16 days at sea. We'd get back, ending up at 10 o'clock at night, leaving the ship at 5:30, and then do one day in harbour to do your paperwork. Now, it was a pretty nasty thing to have to assess commanding officers as a young two-striper. And so we'll go back and say, I'm terribly sorry, but I don't think this fellow's capable of carrying it on. I had to do it with one two-striper who had not commanded anything bigger than his own 16-ton yacht. And he was given an 1,800-ton whaler. It was the biggest whaler in the world, a magnificent craft. And we were out on doing our exercises when we got a call to go and chase a submarine. And he just fell to pieces. And I had 4 days on the bridge. During which time, of course, the coxswain broached the rum and got tight. So the thing that those of you who certainly are in know only too well, the rum was anathema over there. But when we got back, I didn't report this because I felt that he'd learned enough in the time. And he did very well thereafter. But one corvette came in, and it was one my day in harbour, and of course if anything was arriving, the duty staff had to be on deck too. So it meant no difference in one's routine of life. And they anchored in the appointed place, and nothing happened. So Monkey Face said, I'd better send the barge out, perhaps their motorboat's not working. And their motorboat, I might say, was a 16-foot passive skiff. Sometimes they had a little tiny inboard in them, sometimes they had an outboard. But at least he expected them to get in and pull over if necessary, because they were sea boats as well. And the barge was sent over, bring back the captain, and the barge came back and said, well, the captain hasn't any reason to come over. With which, Monkey Face and myself got in there, and we went over, and the quartermaster was blowing a bang. He said, where's your captain? He didn't bother to salute the Commodore, and after all, even the Commodore's brain's fairly bright and big. He didn't bother to salute him, and he came over the side, oh, he's up in his cabin. He didn't lose mate, thank God, or he could have been one dead Commodore. But so we went up there, and there was the captain, and he's number one, and there was about a half a bottle of rum there. And Mikey said, what are you doing? He said, I'm drinking rum, sir. He said, haven't you received my joining instructions on this day? Oh, yes. But why haven't you come over to call on me? He said, oh, in the morning. No, not before 8 o'clock. Didn't say anything like that in my orders, did it? Well, no, sir, no. All right, pack your bags. Hinchcliffe, go and tell the Lochinvar, which is a little craft that plied between Oban, the mainland, and where we were in Tobermory. Incidentally, the first diesel-driven passenger ship in the world. I held it, and that fellow, off he went. So he hit Tobermory somewhere about 5:30, and I think it was 7:30 she used to leave, the Lochinvar. He was on his way, finishing. And this gradually got around, that you had to do your stuff. The other thing was a tremendous thing too, that he finally managed to get a permanent mooring laid instead of having to anchor, or use the anchor. We had to go to sea once every 3 months to qualify for duty-free grog. And this was most essential. Well, especially with everybody coming in. But he got this permanent mooring lead and also a permanent telephone line. And to be in there and hear him say, "Is that the Second City, Lord? Now look here, my boy." My boy would go, so you could hear it coming through loud and clear. Well, I'm getting rid of him, and I'm getting rid of this, and I'm getting rid of that. And gradually, the message did get through to these ships that Tobermory meant business. And it is my very firm belief, and I've held this even from about 2 or 3 weeks after I got there. I think I was there for about 3 weeks before Monkey Face arrived. When we were trying then, there were only two of us, we were trying then to get this thing going. But, say, being junior two stripers and with two and a halves and whatever around the place, one commander, it was a bit of an uphill battle. But I do believe that the Battle of the Atlantic can owe at least 50% of its success to Tobermory. Quite unquestioned. I don't know how many, any of you here have been through it. Did you go through it? Your brother did. But we had, in my time there, we only had two Australians through, I think. One was eventually Rear Admiral Buchanan. He had a converted W, a Ware. And I forgot the other one was Lieutenant VR. Fairly, I think. But we got, the sort of thing we got going was a rifle and pistol range, a depth charge area where we could let go a little here, a depth charge got, which so many have never heard it. March through the town and generally make these poor brutes who'd seen nothing except the barrack square in whichever training depot brought up, or King Alfred, that's right. Had seen that. And in my time there, I personally worked up 36 ships and had a hand in 54. And I've never regretted one minute of it, because it did me the world of good. I had to sharpen up my own thoughts. And to see somebody arrive in a state of complete chaos, and then about 10 days later move off, and all, as they anchored, broke down, came the jack and all this sort of stuff, they were very, very much on the ball. The hardest ones to do anything with were the trawlers, who were real trawlers, I mean the auxiliary service, because the skipper and the second skipper had been at sea all their life fishing. They were more suited really to minesweeping than anti-submarine, because as you well know, the fishing with nets in trawlers, you use the otter boards, which of course are virtually the same as the otter boards used in minesweeping. And they were very adept at that indeed. But as far as the anti-submarine was concerned, you could get them there, and especially the Scottish ones, they'd listen to an echo and they'd hang on to you. You couldn't get a word out of them, not a word. And of course, by this time, the submarine disappeared, so you'd stop everything and they would go, "Look here, you've got to say something." So next time you go around, "No, not a word." Well, occasionally one had to do one's lolly to get something out of this, and one particular day I really took to the skipper. I got on board about 5:45. He had no teeth in, but he had a pipe. And he'd go suck, suck. And by about 9 o'clock, he was about 6 feet in diameter. the bridge was only about from that curtain to me wide, and I'd probably be afloat before long. But I let fly at him, and I said, "Furthermore, don't bloody well keep on spitting." All I got out of that was, "I knew you weren't a parson, son." But we did, then we got on pretty well after that. The food was pretty grim too. Good old enormous potatoes and that sort of stuff, and you all ate in the one place. But I really did get to know the trawler hands in that time, and especially the skippers, and I saw a few of them later on, and they all thanked us very much. And indeed, the last one I saw of those was when I was going up to New Guinea, to take over as NOIC. We landed in Samurai, and I went to pay my call on the harbour master, and who it had been but one of the old trawler hands. He had a wonderful trawler. It could do all of 6 knots, and it took about 45 minutes to get up there. But this was still going out on anti-submarine patrol, my God. But a beautiful ship, everything burnished and everything else. Well, one of the lovely things about old Monkey Face was that he was very, very human. And he said to me one day, well, look here, you've had a hell of a drubbing. I think you better go off on a week's leave. Have you got any relatives in England? I said, no. Where do you want to go then? I'd all go down to London and see the blokes down there. And he said, well, you know my wife, and she had come up, by the way, in the Lochinvar, arrived there, came off on the barge, because the barge happened to be in there, and she said who she was. She arrived on the gangway. Who invited you up here? I told you not to come. Now get ashore. She went off ashore, she went back at the Lochinvar too next morning. But he did relent. He brought her on board for dinner, and we were all introduced, and that's where I met her. And a delightful woman, it really was. And he said to me, well, now look, if you run out of money, don't hesitate. Bring up and go out and stay. Well, I got down there, and at that particular time, there was a thing going around the pubs and clubs called the cigar luncheon, which was supposed to be the Admiralty's method of doing business. I don't know who started it, but the cigar luncheon apparently started at 12 and finished at 3. So when I got down to the anti-submarine office, I said, I've come down for... Well, they said, what are you doing here? And I said, I've come down for one of your cigar luncheons. When do we start? And he said, wait a minute, you're not supposed to be here. Mm-hmm. I turned up my thing, and there it was. I was supposed to be in the Clyde that morning. However, I had a weekend down there. When I went back on board, of course, there was old Monkey with his telescope. And he came into the barge and said, what are you doing here? Didn't I tell you if you ran out of money to go and stay with my wife? I said, yes, sir, I've been appointed away. Oh, no, you haven't. So he went on board. And I'm just saying this because this is a measure of what the RAN officer was thought of before the war over there. He said, no. Sent for the secretary. They went down the appointments list. Nope, you're not here. I said, you mind if I have a look at it? And there it was. Royal Australian Navy, L.M. Hinchley. We'd forgotten you. You were RAN. And this is, as I say, a measure of, if you were a Canadian before the war, they wouldn't give you the same job as we always got. I suppose we've lost that now, because we're not exchanging so much. But Captain Cook's brother was over there in the Royal Oak at that particular time. He had a, I think he was number one, wasn't he?
Made the upper deck.
And it's no trouble at all. You just went over there, you had the necessary stripes, it didn't matter where you came from. Anyway, I went back up to the Clyde and discovered that I was to be the flotilla AS officer of the 7th Flotilla, N-class destroyers, brand new. Napier, the leader, was to complete in a fortnight's time, and Nizam, the next one off the reel, was about 3 or 4 weeks away. And she was building, Navy was building that big yard, Fairfields, and Nizam was down at the place where Queen Mary was built, John Brown's. Well, that was a fairly hectic time because it was so interesting in my book, having to look after the installation of the two ships. And eventually we dropped down the river, having completed with our troops, the first dinner in the wardroom being accentuated by Commander E. Oliver, having to come in a little late, and we're sitting at the end of the table, and suddenly, splat, and there was a decent-sized rat about that big, right into his dinner. These are the sort of things that one keeps on remembering, I'm afraid. But, which I reminded him the other day, too, on Anzac Day. We did our trials, and they weren't without a certain number of tribulations as well, because I'm pretty certain it was then, I may be wrong, there were two occasions when we had frightful gales in the tail of the bank. On neither occasion of which did we see anything. On one of them we were hit. And I don't know whether we were dragging too fast or the other fellow was dragging too fast. You didn't know. It turned out the following morning it was a cruiser that hit us. But on the other occasion, when we were dragging, we came to a halt. And when we weighed the anchor, we had the biggest bunch of copper underwater cable you've ever seen in your life, but it held us. And that was the tail of the bank. When it blew like hell, there was a convoy assembling there, they all got jammed up and everything. Well, we did our trials with the help of Alan Payne here, who was on board, and a few disputes as to the speed accomplished. But I also had a photograph there of the water shoveling over the stern as we were doing our full speed astern trials. But the epidioscope's not here, so we can't show. And we went off to Scarborough to work up the usual business up there. And of course, Scarborough was then sealed. The Royal Oak had gone down earlier, and the shock that they got, that these submarines could get through, was gone. And you were able to do your anti-submarine working up inside Scarborough Flow, which is a marvellous thing, really, because the tidal streams outside were practically impossible for training. And whilst we were doing this, we were selected, I don't know why, perhaps because we were Australian, to go over to a place called Scrabster, which is on the north coast of Scotland, and pick up Mr. Winston Churchill, two or three other big potentates, and Lord Halifax, who was going over to USA as the ambassador, and to take them over to from Scrabster to Scarborough. Well, of course, we're going to do this at full speed, and the Pentland Firth, as you all know, has got a wonderful name for being rough, and has lived up to it. But we got him over there, and away they he embarked on the forgotten the name of the battleship now, the King, the Duke of York. Was it?
Yeah.
It was the Duke of York. Yeah, well, you know. And we took them back. My vivid memory of that one was that as the forecastle officer, one would always had to get the anchor ready for letting go when you'd hoisted it. And there was nothing to change this. And I reported the anchor ready for letting go. But all I got was 30 knots and the water all down up to here, and it was cold. And when I got up the bridge, didn't I bloody well turn? Of course, Churchill was alongside, and the cigar came out and looked me up and down. I can still see that look. But that was old Steve. Stephen Arliss, he stop or full. And we had full that day, all right. One memory of that particular workup was we took, I think it was the Eskimo, which is a tribal class, an E class, and ourselves, took one of these new battleships, partly out of the Atlantic, to release her. And we were doing, I think, 18 knots. And the battleship didn't like this, he think it was too slow. So he came in with, what speed do you think the destroyers can do? So we whacked up to 24 and rowed beautifully. We asked the tribal task what he could do, and he said he thought he could take it, and we asked the little fella. And he said he thought he'd be all right. Well, Steve had been in command of one of that similar type, and he said he thought it would. So up it came 20 knots, you see. And the battle got underway, and it rose, and then went down, and down, and down, and went over the forecastle, went over A turret, went over B turret. And while it was going over B turret, another signal executing a lower speed went up. We could take, but Eskimo the following morning had spit his upper deck, and the little fella was no longer to be seen. He came in a day and a half later in the Scarborough. But that some idea of to us
of what these N-class destroyers could do. They really were magnificent seabirds. Well, we did our work up via going up to the Faroes, which was under snow and under ice. We stayed a night there with everything open, of course, but ice banging on the ship's side. And we went up to Iceland, and there is one of the most hair-raising things that I've ever had in my life. I had the first watch, and the change of watch was half an hour different, as you probably, most ships did this. The PCO took over half an hour later from the ordinary people, and so I was being relieved half an hour late, and I said to the officer of the watch, and he was quite happy about the zigzag. He said, "Oh, yes, sir, yes, sir. Sure," and they turned around, and there was our merchant cruiser, one of the P&O's, and I've never seen a bow looming quite so large and close in my life. Well, I whacked up to 27 knots and hard a starboard and got round the other side and came back, and all I got was old Stephen Arliss, "If you had to change anything in the way of speed or course load, what are you doing? If you said 23 knots and that's what you're doing, you'd be quite happy." So I said 27 knots, coming back to 23, right there, that was all. Didn't come up the bridge. So quite different to a lot of people. Anyway, Lieutenant Commander Plunkett Cole was the next fellow up. And I was just saying to him, "Well, look, you better watch this officer watch, because he zagged when he should have zigged." And there I was, and I turned around and looked, and of course, you know how people follow the pointer. Both of us turned around, and my God, there it was again. But we got to Iceland, to Reykjavik, and to cheese that was available to be bought there, and all that sort of thing. It still sticks in the old memory. And of course, we weren't darkened either. But a few of our blokes got into trouble, because the girls go on one side of the dance hall and the boys on the other. And if you take a girl and sit with her, you mean business. Along to the altar, and we had a little bit of talking the following morning, some fast talking to get rid of a few prospective brides. Well, we had done by then about 4 months up at Scarpa, and we were then told we were going out to the Med. This, of course, was the original idea. The N-class were supposed to have been the reliefs for the scrap iron flotilla, and the crew was about to change over. But this fell apart at the seams, mainly because Captain Waller was not allowed to leave, and I say not allowed to leave, deliberately, by old Andrew Cunningham, the Admiral out there. He reckoned he was too valuable. And the result of that was that we had quite a number of Aryan people coming into the N-class from the word go, including Captain D, who was Stephen Arliss. Now, we went down to Fairfields, and Nijem went to Brown's for the first refit, which was to make good defects from the building. Oh, by the way, I failed to mention, I should do this, that Nijem, the night she arrived in Scarpa, was blowing 4 parts of a gale. He was told to anchor as convenient in the flow, and of course, it was so much snow and muck around that he just let go, and the next thing, crunch, crunch, crunch. Starboard's crew got on to Royal Oak's foremast, and that went on for months and months and months, bent, in fact, years. More of that later on. So they didn't have any time to do anything about that, so we had a quick refit, and while we were there, we had the blitz on Glasgow. It was the only time there were blips. It lasted 2 nights. We had a very small crew on board, and I was caught up in the town of a show, and the captain was on board with the sub who had done this zigging instead of zagging. And we did our firing back, and the following day we did a bit more, the next night we did a bit more firing back. And the two things that stick in my mind from that particular occasion was the gunner. We was ashore on leave. His wife had come up from Devonport, and he rang up on the second morning and said, "Have you ordered 84 replacement charges? 83, rather?" And I said, "No, I've ordered 84. "Why? It's one more." I said, "No, we had to throw one to the drink. And for this day, I don't know whether it's still there in Fairfield's yard, because no one dared to say a word." But the next morning, it had been a very nasty raid. We had an aircraft carrier on the stocks, a cruiser on the stocks, I think two destroyers, and an untold number of landing craft. And somebody came round and said, "Oh, look, there seems to have been a couple of mines gone off around there." Well, they had. One had gone off and moved the bulkhead, complete bulkhead, the carrier and the cruiser was alongside one another. And they said, "Well, there's something in amongst all these landing crafts." And to my horror, I walked out on something. It was pitch black. And it turned out to be a magnetic mine. Fortunately, I had the sea boots I had on were leather, but they didn't have enough steel in them to do anything to it. But I've never forgotten that one. However, we went on to join forces with Nijam and did a troop convoy up to Jib, from Jib to Freetown. From Freetown, we then went on to St. Helena, where we were there for about a day, because we'd run out of bread and bakery had gone rotten. Newcastle had to come in and fuel ahead of us, and we were to take whatever she left. And in the meantime, I was able to, I was a victualling officer, so I was able to see the whole town, and went out and had a piddle on Napoleon's tomb. I thought it was appropriate at that time. And also went up to Longwood and had a look around where he'd been incarcerated. It's a lovely island, St. Helena, and I'd like to go back there again. We then pushed on to Simonstown. We had a ruined dome in Napier. We had to go back into Cape Town, where I did the first of three holes in dry docks. So I left my mark in three places in the world in dry docks to be able to get the dome down. We moved on to Mombasa and had a preview of what we were going to see quite a lot of later on. And then when we got the Surtees, we were mined out of the canal and we missed the evacuation of Greece because of that. However, when we did get round there, we were in time for the rest of it. Now, the reason we went round all the way around Africa, we were the first British destroyers ever to do this, first to call in Cape Town. We had welded on board on our iron deck two sets of double L sweeping gear, because they suspected that the canal had been mined with magnetic mines, and it had been. And also they dropped the first acoustic there, but they cleared them up by running the motor AS boats up and down the canal until they were blown apart, but they did clear it up. And the flying halo, the Wellington. Well, our first operation with the Med fleet was a very big one. We were to go through the Malta to pick up a convoy, and I can vividly remember Captain D-14 saying to us, "Your worst enemy at night is the battleship." And that night we got it. They came over, I don't know whether it was Tazzy or Jerry, it didn't matter, but they came over in profusion. And we were spattered with bits and pieces of overs and shorts from the battleships. They really were nasty. They did fly with everything. And it was shortly after that, of course, that the invasion of Crete came along, and we were very heavily wrapped up in that. Everybody was, of course. And I can, again, very vividly remember the anguish with which one and only aircraft carrier, who only had about four fighters left then, and Lord alone knows they were so slow, I don't suppose they would have been much use, but at least they were deterrent, and at least they were there for us to see, and a moral support. And she got hit, and that was the finish of our aircraft support. We did two in Napier and Nijam. We did two evacuations in successive nights from Sfakia. I was the beachmaster, and again, one of the anomalies of that I'll never understand, I asked if I could take a revolver ashore, because we didn't know whether the Jerrys were in possession of the beach or anything else. We were landing the two whalers and the motorboat from each ship, and that was all. And I was told, no, you can't have one, you might lose it. By the grace of God, almost the first thing I saw when I got ashore, there was a torch and went around the back. Sparky had a little bit of a cliff about the height of this, I suppose. Was a brand new 38, Smith & Wesson 38, full of bullets. And I don't have it still, but my brother-in-law has got it up in the scrub. And it stood me in great stead later on, too. But that particular thing, I don't suppose any of us here will ever have to take part in anything like this again, but we were given ammunition to give them to defend the beach. And there was just nobody there, and I crawled all over it and bellowed, and eventually a couple of majors came down, and I said, well, here we are, we've got the ammunition and the food, where do you want it? And he said, well, we'll put that over here. I said, well, where are the troops to bring it? They said, oh, you unload that. So I said, what? These fellows are going to pull your chaps out to the ships, pull in again and pull back, take this. And I threw one at him, and that was all I gave him. Maybe they unloaded it in the end. But that was the sort of feeling there, that the Navy was there, they could do the whole damn lot. Well, we didn't get many off that night because things were not organised, but the next night we were in, we really did our stuff, and on our way up, Nijem and ourselves, enceritis or something, but we got there, and this time someone had taken up some landing craft, and the New Zealanders were there. And the New Zealanders, they had their greatcoats, they had a bandolier, they had a rifle, and they were forming hollow squares where the landing craft were. And it was magnificent to see what was going on. The first night was just very ragged. The RAF came down. They were all ground staff and all badly wanted back in Africa. And a brigadier said, what are you going off for? You stand back, the RAF, which I countermanded as a two-striper. But I was beachmaster, and that caused a bit of an upset. But that was a sort of, again, a bit of the thinking that was going on there. Well, we shoved off, and I think Nijem slipped off first, and we went off second. But I had taken precaution that night that if we were going to be left behind as the beach party, that I'd sail a whaler back. And was he was then Petty Officer Hughes, I had all the whalers' sailing gear up near X Gun, and with almost begging instructions to, God's sake, heave this over the side if I don't get back. Well, it wasn't necessary because I did get back, and away we went. But we got solidly attacked on the way back that day, and we came to a standstill in Napier. And we thought Nijem had gone a couple of times too. She was completely covered with water. But we got back, and that was that. Napier was no longer in. Well, from memory, I think we had two battleships, one of which was slightly damaged, two cruisers and about 16 destroyers, all of which had something wrong with them. And that was all that was left of the great fleet after Crete. But there was no rest for the wicked, because the Syrian campaign started off, and away they went up there, bombarding and patrolling, and had an action with the French. And of course the Tobruk ferry run was going on at the time as well. I left Napier and went to Nijem's number one, and we went back up to Syria. That was quite an interesting campaign, and the final part of that was the concentration bombardment by destroyers on a plantation at Damur, and while we were still doing it, way they tossed their hands in. But it was rather eerie. One night we were pretty close into the Beirut breakwater. You could hear the bands in the nightclubs going on, but no one bothered to come up to us. They really got it. The other thing there was, I don't know whether this is big enough to be able to see, but it's not really. But Beirut's there, Alexandria's down here. So the course between the two is roughly southwest. And we, on our way back after it was all over, we were attacked by a great swarm of RAA, or RAF, aircraft, as an Italian invasion fleet. Now, can you think of anybody up top there steering that course, coming from Italy, which is, as you know, completely and utterly in the opposite direction? And that's again one of the things that one had to put up. Of course, so did they, because I think I was on board Nizam when we got a signal. We had just shot down our one and only long-range fighter protection. It just came in and buzzed us up. No one said it was anything about it, so it was bang, away she went. But from then, while the people licked their wounds, and some of the wounds were pretty nasty too, bent guns. I never expected to see guns just bent back like that from blast, bomb blast. Other oddities were the Nubian. You saw a destroyer, and it came down pretty sharply, and then some distance back, sticking out of the water, was a red flag. Well, yeah, that was the end of Nubia. The shafts were all there, the steering gear was all there, but all the stuff up top had gone. I'd forgotten what it was, the bomb and the depth charge, but the water stopped the shock going any further, and there it was. Many wrinkles and splits and so on. We had splits and whatever. And we started off on this Tobruk ferry, as we were the first ones to go up there, the big destroyers. It wasn't expected we'd be able to manoeuvre inside the harbour. And we went up with D, who had to say whether it was yay or nay. We got there and we got back all right. And it was approved that the larger destroyers could do the job. Well, we did 13 or 14 runs of the Brook, and I've still not seen it in daylight. One run, we unfortunately collided with the wreck that we were putting our bodies and cargo on board, but it wasn't too rough outside. By the time we'd wound up to 30 knots, we were not lapping much water in. Another morning we were coming back, and we had that dreadful old stuff, the radar, which ASF, which was an aircraft thing, and it could only tell you vaguely whether it was starboard or port, no proper bearing. And we suddenly saw this thing. It was too late, the bomb had gone, and we went right up like this. When it became daylight again, we saw that radar aerial had dropped down. Of course, to this day, everybody swears that the aircraft was so low that it hit. But there was so much weapon and the part, which is a pretty solid aerial, I think it had gone. But we were stopped for some time then, and we got under tow. The tow parted. We got underway again and got in. And the only other nasty incident was Lady Bird was bombed to a stand. Lady Bird was a China River gunboat, very good for bombardment, 6-inch gun. I think she'd either been torpedoed by a submarine or torpedoed from the air. I can't remember which, but anyway, we were sent back to tow her in. And we had the towing wire flaked out along the iron deck. Well, it was just one of those terrible things that destroyers, because of their underwater shape, suffer from, and that is they are inclined to broach at certain sea states and speeds. And sure enough, we were told to abandon this stupid idea and go back. We had about 200 or 300 diggers on board, And it was about, I suppose, 20 minutes after we turned and were going along when one of these things occurred. We broached, the starboard side went right under. A hell of a lot of them managed to hang on to the wire, which was flaked down. If it hadn't been there, we'd have lost more than half of them. We lost 7 of our own crew on that. And it was rather a blemish on the whole thing. The rest of the time, it was looking after the battleships or cruisers or trying to get someone through to Malta, or going up and pooping off at the Italians with our night bombardments. All this time, Nizam was doing this. Rattle, rattle, rattle. We used to have to go in very, very regularly and get the stern bearing re-metalled. And we'd go off nicely for a while and no vibration. But that also flowed through to X-mounting, which being not knowing or not thinking properly, I suppose, we left it in the one spot. And it gradually, with the vibration, got flats on the ball bearings in the training. It was the first time it had apparently occurred, that of course went round the fleet pretty quickly, keep them moving. And then we had one brush with the Italian battle fleet. My only time that I've had 15-inch bricks fired at me. We were trying to get something through to Malta. Admiral Vine was in command. We only had cruisers. And we'd been under attack since dawn by aircraft, and a hell of a lot of them. And then, it'd be about 6 o'clock, just before sunset, when the captain sent for me. He said, "Are you ready for surface action, number one?" Well, I looked up, and there were 12 88s up there and some over here. And I, "Sir? Surface action?" He said, "Look over there." And there were two battleships. You could just see their topmast. And we were then ordered, four of us, to close and attack enemy battle fleet with torpedoes. Well, you can imagine the thoughts that were in our minds when we chuffed off at full speed to go into these 15-inch boys. And I remember the first salvo coming over 15-inch. A fellow whom many of you may remember, you will, McClymont, he told me afterwards that I'd muttered, "My God, just like a train coming out of a tunnel." It just was that sort of swishing noise, and of course a rather lovely thump. Well, fortunately, we only did about 5 minutes, I think, of hearing in towards these fellows, and put up a smoke screen and turned away. But we were that the finish of that day was terrific. I reckon we had these 12 88s. High levelers. We had about the same number dive bombing and torpedo bombers from every point of the compass, and they didn't get a hit. Nothing at all, thank God. Well, we shoved off back to Alex, and that's the only time that I can ever remember a torpedo going underneath and not coming off, because later on I was sunk with torpedoes, but I could hear this thing through, and I lit off for the upper pretty hard, I can tell you. We did a few more of those, and then we were on the screen with three battleships just at the south of Crete when Barron was sunk by a submarine. And that was an incredible sight. Being anti-submarine, of course, any underwater explosion I used to light off straight away. And I just got up there in time to see her heeling over and then exploding. You see a 15-inch turret go skywards is something awe-inspiring, I must admit, and a great pall of stuff. We didn't get that submarine. The Australians were blamed for it, but the thing was, it was on the other side. The screen, we were on one side of the screen, there was on the other, and it was quite clearly the other side of the screen that got it. I had a small battle in the anti-submarine world over that for years, but there was no question of that. I'd just like to impress that, because some of you may have heard the same thing. We managed to pick up a lot of survivors, mainly because, and this is where Happy Jack is always one ahead of everybody, the captain of the side had very carefully left the great catamarans, and this thing very nearly as long as this room, which were they carried, of course, for ships to berth alongside. He'd left that unsecured. And there were 32 blokes got away on that. But the only thing that did get away intact. And we went alongside it. And we were stopped. And I remember with the bearing out spars, pushing it away and saying, right, that bridge. And up came the engineer officer, Commander Wilson, and said, I think we've fouled the starboard screw one. I looked at it, and my God, we had. This thing had been upside down. The 2.5-inch wires for securing it were not visible. They were hanging straight down, and we'd got one of those. Well, we put an ERA over the side to cut it off, and the torpedo bombers came into us, and the result of that is I've got half of one ear. So I will never forget that one. Because I had him on the line, and I just I could have released him, I suppose. But one doesn't. It was shortly after that that, in fact, I'm not too certain that it wasn't one when I returned that night, that the human torpedoes went in with us. And we were alongside a tanker, refueling. She was here, the QE was there, the Valiant was up there. And in the middle of the night, whoosh, we were shaking, it was a really lot of shaking. No damage to us, but the stern of the tanker had gone, and of course the QE was sunk, and there was an enormous hole in the Valiant. She spent a couple of months in dock. You could have put a whole trawler inside her and just sealed it, you'd never have known it was there. It was an enormous hole. Well, we moved on just after that to the Far East, the two of us, and joined up with the motley collection of stuff which is known as the Eastern Fleet. And out there, spirit was good. Some of the flesh was pretty weak. The R-class battleships used to go along like that and submerge themselves. And they were always wanting water. In fact, we, even in Napier, we gave away some water later on. But our first real task when we got out there was to pick up the Indomitable, take her up to Port Sudan and pick up Crate and Hurricanes. And a whole host of RAF pilots who'd never flown off a carrier, of course, but they were uncrated on the way across to the Indian Ocean to fly them into Java. We got rid of the first lot reasonably well. One made a noise like a chaff cutter and had to circuit. And he eventually was way behind, absolutely straight and level, and when he got to that downdraft, he looked as though he was going to the quarterdeck, and he went up, but he managed to get back on board. He was white-haired next morning, though. We did a second run of that, and were nearly going to fly him off, and we were told to push him off into Ceylon, and they were the ones that did the Japanese no good when they tried to attack from their carriers. They had no idea they were there, and they really got a pasting. Well, Adieu Atoll became our headquarters, as far as the Eastern Fleet was concerned, and that's there. They're crossing the equator like a yo-yo. And we were heavily defended there. I think the 6-inch guns were about Mark 1s, so that they, if one was fired inboard, in other words into the lagoon, I doubt it could have got to the other side of it. But such is life. And we did a lot of sweeps. In June, or well, one night we, what was known as the First 11, a couple of good carriers, the Warspite and the Modern Destroyers, it looked as though we were going to get caught up with the Japs. We were very close, but I think a lot of the fire eaters would have been quite happy, but fortunately Sir James Somerville, who was a fire eater really, he pushed on for so far and then came back. And we didn't have that action. I don't know, very interesting to speculate on what might have happened had that occurred. We next jaunt was into the Med, where we lost Nestor, I think, And then shortly after that I went back to England, was sunk on the way. Learnt about the new anti-submarine doctrine, went across the Atlantic in a Canadian destroyer, was flown across the Pacific in an American seaplane or flying boat, and arrived back in Australia in my usual state, fourpence Fijian, having had all my wallet pinched in Fiji. Well, I went up north after that, having done a stint in Rushcutter for a similar sort of job as working up latest ships, and it was very quiet. I don't think I was there for one bomb or anything else, but I came back at the end of the war, towards the end of the war, I was appointed to number one of Shropshire. The war fell through, and instead of getting number one of Shropshire, I got a command. And that was the finish of the war. Well, I'm sorry if I bored you. I'm sorry that I hadn't got the epidioscope, but there is one thing which I tried to get out and to print in the N-class destroyer or the V's or something, which maybe you'd like to see. This was done by a lieutenant in one of the RN destroyers that did the Tobruk run, and it really does tell you. It was almost a routine going up and down there. Tea time, Charlie used to get his bomb about 4:05 and so on. Well, I'll leave this up here for anybody who'd like to see it. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.